I next met with Dr. Eunice Wang, and to begin, she presented a 61-year-old patient from her practice. Okay, well, let's sort of jump into the meat of this, and I thought we could start out talking about targeted therapy, maybe begin with this 61-year-old African-American woman. So can you talk a little bit about how she presented?
Sure. So this is one of the patients that I took care of when I was covering the leukemia inpatient service. She's a 61-year-old African-American woman, and she had been referred to us from our breast cancer colleagues. She had had diagnosis of triple negative breast cancer, which had presented a year or two earlier. She underwent bilateral mastectomies followed by adjuvant chemotherapy and unfortunately had presented with some chest pain and some respiratory symptoms as was found to have significant pulmonary and liver metastases. So she was on some maintenance therapy and was being followed closely by her oncologist when she presented to the breast clinic with easy bruising and ecchymoses on exam and just feeling very fatigued. What we found on examination was that she had a high white count, she had anemia and thrombocytopenia, which was new, and she had evidence of circulating peripheral blasts. So she was admitted to the leukemia inpatient service for further workup and diagnosis. We performed a bone marrow biopsy and determined that she unfortunately had acute myeloid leukemia, likely therapy-related, we think, maybe in relation to the chemotherapy that she had gotten, but it was interesting that it was MLL translocated, consistent with the therapy related, but also was characterized by a presence of a FLT3 ITD mutation, which is found in about a third of patients with acute myeloid leukemia and can be found most commonly in normal karyotype AML as well as other cytogenetic subsets.
So before you get into how she was treated, maybe we can just take a step back and talk about a couple of things. First of all, in terms of workup, again, from the point of view of the general medical oncologist, what do you consider sort of the essential workup of a patient presenting with AML?
All right. So I think, first of all, patients we present with AML generally have some sort of hematologic compromise, cytopenias, elevated white count. So the first thing I look at is to see whether there is anything diagnostic in the peripheral blood. If there are increased numbers of peripheral blasts, and generally anything above 20%, you can actually perform a lot of the diagnostic testing to make a diagnosis of AML just from the peripheral blood. In other instances, you'll need to perform a bone marrow biopsy. And so for either the bone marrow or the blood, there's about four things that absolutely need to be done in this day and age to make that diagnosis. One is the conventional hematopathologist looking at the size, the shape, the morphology of the blast, and really distinguishing, is this an acute versus a chronic? Is it an APL? Is it an ALL? So hematopathology, including any cytochemistry or stains they have to do, is essential, and blast count. The second thing would be to look at flow cytometry and to determine that there's myeloid versus lymphoid expression, and again to rule out APL. Particular nowadays with a lot of the targeted therapies, we are interested in knowing if a AML cell expresses CD33 because we have CD33 directed targets and we have experimental agents that are targeting another antigen expressed on stem cells, which is CD123. Following that, the third thing we look at is cytogenetic. We look at conventional cytogenetics and karyotype, and we also look at fluorescent in situ hybridization for specific translocations, which are diagnostic for acute myeloid leukemia. And that includes translocation 821, inversion 3 for acute promyelocytic leukemia, translocation 1517. We know that in acute myeloid leukemia, the most robust and validated prognostic marker for patients with AML is really cytogenetic abnormalities and whether they fall within a favorable intermediate or unfavorable karyotype. However, half of the patients that present with AML are going to have a normal karyotype. So the fourth and most important thing nowadays in many people's minds is to do the molecular characterization. We do next-gen sequencing looking for a panel of myeloid genes that are commonly mutated in AML. But therapeutically, we now have targeted agents, as you mentioned, that are directed against FLT3 mutations, IDH1 and IDH2 mutations. It's important to recognize that the most common mutation in AML is FLT3. and that only occurs in about 25 to 37% of patients. So there's no mutation in this disease that is found in more than a third. IDH1 is probably found in 5 to 10%, and IDH2 probably in 10 to 15%. So between the two of them, IDH1, IDH2, really found in less than 20% of AML patients.
So let's get back to your patient, because it seems like a really provocative situation. She's got metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, which has a pretty poor prognosis, and, you know, sort of coloring this. Was she symptomatic? What was her performance status?
She was pretty good. She was fatigued. She was tired, but she was still eating well. You know, obviously, she was very discouraged. She had a long therapy with surgery and chemotherapy to get the metastatic breast diagnosis and then the acute myeloid leukemia diagnosis. But she wasn't really willing to give up. And at the time that we saw her, breast cancer was relatively stable, was not actively spreading. So the decision was made after consultation with her and her husband to go forward with treatment for her acute myeloid leukemia. So she went ahead and received standard, what we call upfront chemotherapy, since she was fairly fit, with an intensive chemotherapy regimen, cytarabine and daunorubicin, also known as 7+3, with the addition of a FLT3 inhibitor, midostaurin.
So how did she tolerate therapy and respond to it?
So she did all right. She certainly was not willing to give up and wanted aggressive therapy, and she initially did fairly well with it. She was sort of, I think, a little bit depressed. She was not walking around as much as we would have liked, but she tolerated relatively well. She had no significant life-threatening complications, although she did drop her counts and was transfusion-dependent. The most troubling thing really was that at the time that she started to have count recovery, about 28, 32 days after starting therapy, she started having peripheral blasts. So it appeared that despite her tolerability and her willingness to undergo intensive therapy, that she really had disease which was refractory to the initial FLT3 inhibitor and standard chemotherapy.
So I don't know exactly when this occurred, but I would have thought that CPX-351 might have been a consideration in this woman. Was it?
It could have been, and CPX-351 is a liposomal formulation of cytarabine daunorubicin, really indicated for therapy-related AML. That definitely was something that we had considered. However, as of now, we don't have tolerability data combining CPX-351 with a FLT3 inhibitor. In the phase 3 study of older patients, 60 and above, that had therapy-related AML, definitely CPX-351 performed better and had improved overall survival and CR rates as compared to regular 7+3 or non-liposomal cytarabine daunorubicin. But that was in the absence of a targeted inhibitor. FLT3 patients in that study, when they went back and did subset analysis, benefited from CPX-351 and definitely did not suffer any untoward side effects or do worse with CPX in the FLT3 mutant setting. But in this situation, I think given her high white count, we did elect to do the FLT3 inhibitor, although I do agree that we could have used CPX.
So it's been kind of hard for me, and I'm sure most general medical oncologists, to kind of get a feel about CPX and also, you know, why it even works. What's your vision of it? Do you think it's better tolerated?
I think that it was interesting. So CPX, the liposomal formulation, was developed as a novel way to give cytarabine daunorubicin. We've been struggling with trying to improve upon, as you know, the efficacy of 7+3 for over 40 years. And this was our latest attempt to do that. There's a lot of solid tumor drugs, I believe, for breast cancer, pancreatic cancer, which are liposomal formulations. And the encapsulation of water-soluble drugs within a nanosphere or liposome has allowed better penetration into the bone marrow space, which is the source of all acute leukemias, and allows better pharmacokinetics in terms of steady-state levels for 24, 48, even a few days. Cytarabine, as you know, has a very short half-life in the peripheral blood, only about 15 minutes. And that's why the cytarabine that we give usually is continuous infusion, because otherwise we won't be able to get therapeutic levels. So I think personally, what is the benefit of liposomal versus standard? I think it's in those subtypes of acute myeloid leukemia that traditionally don't respond well to 7+3. I mean, if you have a favorable karyotype or even an intermediate, your cells are going to be relatively sensitive to cytarabine and daunorubicin, leading to favorable or intermediate outcomes. But those patients that have adverse outcomes, they're not responding. They don't maybe get enough drug in there. And the ability to get a little bit more drug penetration into that bone marrow space potentially would lead to improvement just by getting more drug in there, getting more exposure of the cancer cells to those cytotoxic compounds. I think that is probably what is responsible for the improvement, but only in those subsets of patients that don't typically respond.
That's very interesting. So getting back to this lady, as you mentioned, she got 7 plus 3 plus midostaurin. Sounds like she didn't respond very well. But before we go on, can you just sort of backtrack a little bit and talk about the types of FLT3 mutations that are seen, the agents that we have out there, and the data that supported this initial decision to give her midostaurin?
So as I mentioned, you know, FLT3 mutations are found in about a third of patients with acute myeloid leukemia in the newly diagnosed space. Now, the majority of those mutations are going to be mutations. About 60% of those mutations, or two-thirds of the FLT3 mutations, are going to be in the internal tandem duplication, which leads to repeats within the mutated kinase. That is associated with very poor outcome. Patients that have those ITD mutations tend to be younger patients, normal karyotype, intermediate karyotype. They present with high white counts, and they tend to have clinically aggressive disease. Now, much of the data suggests that patients with FLT3 ITD mutations can go into remission at similar rates as FLT3 wild type, but they relapse. So the typical setting is they'll go into CR or they'll be refractory. If they go into CR, they'll relapse again after another one or two cycles. FLT3 tyrosine kinase domains make up about 20 to 30% of the mutations, less common at diagnosis, much harder to detect. So from a diagnostic point of view, we can do PCR for internal tandem duplications and for specific tyrosine kinase domain mutations in 835 domain, for example. But many FLT3 tyrosine kinase domain mutations require next-gen sequencing for detection. So they're a little bit more occult, not quite as common. And when we look at prognostic studies in the absence of FLT3 inhibitors, not quite as poor prognosis. There are some studies that say FLT3 D835 mutations really don't affect overall prognosis. The problem with D835 mutations is that they still are driving disease. And when we look at the array of FLT3 tyrosine kinase inhibitors that have been developed, the type of mutation makes a big difference. Certain of our tyrosine kinase inhibitors are only able to target and inhibit specific types of mutations. So, for example, midostaurin and gilteritinib, which are the two FLT3 inhibitors who are currently approved for both newly diagnosed and refractory relapsed FLT3 mutant AML respectively, really are of the type that would inhibit both ITD and D835 mutations. On the other hand, other FLT3 tyrosine kinase mutations like sorafenib, which was repurposed from its role in solid tumors to inhibit FLT3, as well as another FLT3 inhibitor, quizartinib, those particular inhibitors only target the FLT3 ITD. And the development of D835 or tyrosine kinase domain mutations is a very relevant therapy resistance mechanism that can develop in patients over time. So characterization of the FLT3 mutations is important, looking at both PCR as well as next-gen sequencing. On the other hand, as we talked about, diagnostically, FLT3 ITD mutations, sometimes those tandem duplication mutations are very large and they're not picked up by sequencing. So again, the importance of doing both molecular analyses for both the PCR for the ITD as well as next-gen sequencing for D835. So in terms of efficacy, there's validation of the importance of FLT3 inhibition and how it adds to conventional chemotherapy. The addition of midostaurin to standard 7 plus 3 as this patient received has been shown to have significant benefits, about a 7% overall survival benefit at 4 years. The complete remission rate, interestingly, was the same, but it appears that the major benefit of the agent is preventing relapse. That data was a little bit skewed because in patients in the RATIFY trial by Stone and colleagues in New England Journal of Medicine, 57% of patients in that phase 3 trial did go on to transplant. So we think midostaurin works best in the upfront setting in combination with 7+3 and ideally in the combination with an allogeneic stem cell transplant. Gilteritinib is a second generation, more potent FLT3 inhibitor, which was designed for patients who have relapse refractory disease, very aggressive disease. And the phase 3 trial with gilteritinib compared a single drug, gilteritinib, taken once a day to high dose chemotherapy as well as low dose chemotherapy for relapse refractory leukemia. And astonishingly enough, this pill and the targeted potency of this FLT3 inhibitor outdid standard intensive chemotherapy with a few month survival benefit. However, it must be pointed out that the only patients that had the best long-term survival, again, in the FLT3 mutant setting was those that went on to transplant.
So as you mentioned, this patient really didn't respond very well. What was the next step?
So the next step, we went on to start her on the gilteritinib. So she, at that point, I think with all of her prior medical history for the breast cancer, metastatic disease, having failed intensive chemotherapy with refractory disease, at that point, she was pretty beat up, discouraged as well mentally and physically. So we were able to initiate an outpatient tyrosine kinase inhibitor and support her well enough that she was actually able to go home from the hospital on that. She's now been on therapy for about 2 or 3 months with the gilteritinib. We have seen recurrence of some circulating blasts, but for right now, she's continuing, we think, to quote unquote have clinical benefit with the drug, remaining outpatient, having some quality of life, and we're looking for additional, maybe experimental agents for her if she continues to progress.
Any tolerability issues that she's experiencing or that you've seen other patients experience with gilteritinib?
So gilteritinib in general is well tolerated. There is a pretty high incidence of cytopenias associated with that agent. So one of the things that we saw was her counts were recovering with peripheral blasts. And when we started the gilteritinib, they all fell again. So generally, myelosuppression is something to keep an eye on. They also get some LFT abnormalities, which in her case, we kept an eye on as well because of the presence of her liver metastases. And some of our patients, you know, they do get some nausea and some vomiting, but mostly the liver function tests abnormalities. There can be some patients that get QTC prolongation, which is something to look at. And some patients do develop orthostatic hypotension and peripheral edema. So those are all things that we've kept an eye on in her case. However, in general, most patients are able to tolerate this well with some dose adjustments in the outpatient setting. And the benefit of gilteritinib is that generally activity of the drug occurs fairly quickly. So we generally see the counts falling. And if patients are going to respond, we would tend to see a response within 4 to 8 weeks of starting the drug.
So from your point of view, when you think about FLT3 mutations and drugs like gilteritinib, midostaurin, do you think it sort of, you know, follows the concept of a driver mutation? When the drug is used as monotherapy, do most patients have some type of response?
In our study, in patients who have not been heavily pretreated with FLT3 inhibitors, unlike this patient who had gotten midostaurin, we had seen about half of patients really respond to the drug. And there's some studies that have been done at larger cancer centers, MD Anderson, saying that if you've been repeatedly, and this would be exposed to FLT3 inhibitor therapy, by the time you get to gilteritinib, it might not work as well. I think in patients who are relatively naive to the drug, we do get probably 30 or 50% response rates in the ADMIRAL trial with a phase 3 trial. The overall CR/CRI rate was about 30%. So I would say about 30 to 50%. But then there are some patients like our patient who didn't technically get a complete remission, but the drug has kept their disease under check as an outpatient now for 2 or 3 months. So I think there is also something to be said, particularly in older patients that have comorbidities or other diseases as she did, to have some clinical benefit of the drug in the absence of pure CR.
You know, and I think about a waterfall plot in a solid tumor, for example, lung cancer with an EGFR tumor mutation is getting, you know, an EGFR TKIs. Most of the patients, almost all of them go down. They don't all fit the criteria for a response.
Right.
And that's kind of what I was getting at. How often do you see people sort of blow right through it?
Occasionally we do. People that have very aggressive disease, as you said, it's a driver mutation. So I think that the reason that, for example, your original question, like why did we use a FLT3 inhibitor and not use CPX? That's because my preference is to use a FLT3 agent because I feel like specifically blocking that driver mutation may be more beneficial clinically than just giving more cytotoxic. That's just my bias, but I do feel like inhibiting that driver mutation is potentially putting the brakes on something that's driving or propelling the disease forward, as opposed to standard cytotoxic chemotherapy, which affects everything equally, right?
How much do you think adding midostaurin in this upfront situation is affecting long-term outcomes?
My preference and my bias is to use a FLT3 inhibitor in upfront therapy. First of all, as with any cancer, the best chance you have to treat the disease is in the upfront setting. Okay, you don't want to be in the relapse refractory setting because by the time you relapse and refractory, inevitably the feeling is that you're going to die from your disease. So when you look at the data with RATIFY, which is the randomized phase 3 trial randomizing FLT3 mutant patients to either midostaurin 7+3 or placebo 7+3, if you look at the curves separate out very early in the treatment, probably during induction. And that difference in event-free survival, it persists through the rest of therapy and results in that 7% difference in 4-year overall survival benefit. So if you look very carefully, I think the major benefit of using the midostaurin is in the upfront setting, in suppressing that clone. And I'll tell you right now, Dr. Love, people have said to me, well, maybe I don't have to give a FLT3 inhibitor. Maybe I could get away with just standard chemotherapy in the upfront setting. Or there's a very, what we look at what we call allelic ratio. Well, the allelic ratio is really low. I don't need to deal with that FLT3. I'll just give them cytotoxin. My experience is that if you do not treat the FLT3 mutation up front, then when they relapse, that FLT3 mutation is there at relapse and the variant allelic frequency ratio has gone up and it is driving the recurrence. So I said, if you detect the FLT3, if I see it and I have a drug for it, I'm going to use it. You know, you don't say, well, you know, there's a few leukemia cells with it. I'm not going to bother with it. Because at the time of relapse, we've seen a 1% or 5% clone make up 50 or 80% of the relapse. So I think if you see it at diagnosis, you treat it.
So are there ongoing phase 3 trials looking at other FLT3 inhibitors, maybe more potent FLT3 inhibitors like gilteritinib in this upfront setting?
Yes. So the trial with midostaurin, the RATIFY trial was done through the cooperative groups and international groups, and that was done over 10 years ago. Our site participated in that study. It took about 10 years to get that data published. Midostaurin was not developed as a FLT3 inhibitor. It was actually developed as a VEGF inhibitor. I was in the days, remember, as you can recall, where they were developing VEGF inhibitors for renal cell, subsequently for hepatocellular carcinoma. So that drug, midostaurin, or PKC-412, was really a repurposed tyrosine kinase because they noticed that when they looked at the tyrosine kinase profile, it also inhibited FLT3. And when they gave it to some patients that had FLT3 mutant, they saw some peripheral blood clearance. So they said, let's combine it with standard chemo. Since that time, we have developed very potent specific drugs, their ability to inhibit very potently and specifically FLT3 ITD and FLT3 TKD. Those drugs, gilteritinib is an example of those, really have efficacy in the relapse refractory setting, whereas midostaurin just caused a little bit of peripheral blood clearance. When you gave midostaurin as a single agent, you saw no responses, nothing, no CR. You saw peripheral blood clearance and that was it. So obviously now that we have gilteritinib approved in the relapse setting, we would like to move those potent FLT3 inhibitors, as you said, up front. So there currently are 3 phase 3 trials, which are ongoing, looking at each one of the newer generation FLT3 inhibitors, quizartinib, crenolinib, and gilteritinib, and comparing the addition of each of those more potent FLT3 inhibitors in combination with 7+3 as compared to 7+3 alone or 7+3 plus midostaurin, which is now the new standard. Initial results in the phase 2 setting have suggested that, for example, the addition of crenolinib to 7+3 or gilteritinib to 7+3, now in contrast to midostaurin, actually increases the CR rate. When you looked at the midostaurin plus 7+3 did not improve the CR rate, but improved the overall survival rate. We're now seeing with the newer drugs, CR rates of 80-90%, which are about 20% higher than the 59% we saw with midostaurin, which was the same as standard of care. So whether that 20 or 30% improvement in CR results in overall survival benefit, we're optimistic, but we're going to need to wait for those phase 3s to result.
Any projections on when we will see some results?
I think those trials are accruing now, so I would imagine probably in a couple years. Some of the early phase 1, phase 2 data has already come out with crenolinib, for example, +7, +3. In about 27 months, they report an overall survival about 70%. So we're going to need to wait and see. I mean, those were only a handful of patients. I would say about 2 or 3 years, we're going to get a sense. I think that people are already eager to move that to the upfront setting. In addition, as you mentioned, you know, upfront setting, is there a benefit for that? We like to bring drugs into the upfront setting. If we can get more people into complete remission, maybe more people could go to transplant. And we think that transplant is something that we're routinely offering these FLT3 mutant patients to prevent them from relapsing.
You see FLT3 in MDS?
Rarely. Because FLT3 is, as you mentioned, a driver mutation, it is associated with excess proliferation. MDS is really characterized by lack of proliferation. It's the opposite. It's a bone marrow failure syndrome. Patients don't present with high counts. They present with no counts. So we do see it. We do look for it, but it tends to be a rare entity. What we find more often in myelodysplastic syndrome is really some of the other mutations, IDH1 and IDH2.
Right. You mentioned allelic ratio. Could you explain exactly what that is? I think I've heard about allelic burden and how you interpret it.
So allelic ratio is really used to describe the percentage of cells within the patient's presentation that really have that mutation. So it's only used for ITD. There's no tyrosine kinase domain or TKD mutation allelic ratio. When we look at allelic ratio, we're really looking at FLT3 ITDs. And generally, people have interpreted that as taking the amount of mutant FLT3 that they're getting in a patient and putting it over the amount of wild type FLT3. So it's kind of like a percentage. So if you have this much mutant and this much wild type, what percentage of the total leukemic burden is really FLT3 mutant? And people have looked at that because in the past, in the absence of FLT3 mutant therapy, when we looked, we knew that FLT3 ITD was a poor prognostic marker. And if you looked at the allelic ratio, it just makes sense. The more FLT3 mutant cells you have, or the higher the allelic ratio or the allelic burden, it's the same thing, the worse the prognosis, right? Because you had more of the mutant cells and less of the wild type. And so those cells are driving chemo resistance and refractoriness and aggressive disease, so they would do worse. And people use that to say, well, if you had a very, very low allelic burden, tiny amount, maybe you didn't need to have a transplant to get rid of it. Maybe you could get rid of those mutant cells just with chemotherapy. Whereas if you had a very high allelic ratio, you were going to do poorly with chemo and you needed to be transplanted. Now, those studies were done in the absence of these newer FLT3 inhibitors. When we look at the FLT3 inhibitor data, particularly with midostaurin that we have the most data with, midostaurin helped everybody. So does allelic ratio predict for response? No. You have high, you have low, you have almost non-existent. You're all going to respond. Are you going to benefit? Do the patients with more allelic burden do better in terms of their outcomes than people with low allelic ratios? Again, the answer is no. So does allelic ratio make a difference in this era of new therapy? I don't think it makes a difference prognostically or response-wise. The way that we're looking now at looking at this allelic ratio is to use it as a measure of minimal residual disease. So there are people that say if you're able to eradicate all of the mutant allelic ratio with your FLT3 inhibitor or with your chemotherapy, your outcome is going to be better. So the mutant allelic ratio or tumor burden has gone from being a poor prognostic thing now in the era of targeted therapy, not to be prognostic, but really to be a marker of measurable residual disease.
So when you put a patient on a FLT3 inhibitor, does it go away? Does the allelic ratio go to zero? Or
it can go to zero. And in early studies using an assay that's still not commercially available, but in development, patients who cleared their allelic ratio, independent of whether it's high or low, had better outcomes than those that didn't.
But from your point of view, if a patient has 1 or 2%, are you still going to treat?
Yes, because as I mentioned, particularly in the upfront setting, if I say I'm not going to do anything about it now, then what's going to happen is a few months later, they're going to relapse and then they're going to have 50%. And I'm going to say, oops, maybe I really should have done something up front. And I think that our experience is that if you have a FLT3 clone, they tend to be chemo resistant. And so you may not necessarily benefit the patient. You may give them chemotherapy and you may get rid of all the FLT3 wild type cells. And the cells that remain are the chemo resistant FLT3. And those are responsible for relapse. So if you have an agent and you can add it up front, as I said, your best chance to get rid of the disease and cure the patients in the upfront setting.
So what do you see in this woman's future? And if she does have progression, what do you think her next therapy is, putting trial aside?
I'm not sure. I think that she's weighing how much more she wants to do. I think that unfortunately, with the presence of the metastatic breast cancer, she's not a candidate for transplantation. So with two active malignancies, the options certainly aren't good. We are going to try to maintain her. We're going to try to get her on a clinical trial that'll allow her to have treatment, even though she has a second malignancy. We may try some off-label agents, and we're really focusing on quality of life and duration of life, particularly as an outpatient for her.
What about venetoclax combinations in her?
Certainly, we could look at that. Venetoclax in the relapse refractory setting has been somewhat disappointing. I know that some centers have reported venetoclax in the relapse refractory setting with response rates as low as 20%. So certainly we could consider that. What we'd love to do would be to, again, in the context of a clinical trial, combine a FLT3 inhibitor with something else. So we know the gilteritinib is controlling her disease. Do we want to layer a hypomethylating agent on with it? We'd love to be able to add venetoclax to it. Again, something outpatient. So I think the future for her is to see whether there's other regimens that we could add on to a FLT3 inhibitor to give her more time.
You know, it's interesting when you see patients who have two cancers like this, it also kind of brings up the opportunity to see whether the treatment of one affects the treatment of the other.
Right.
You know, occasionally you see cases like that are kind of interesting. So, you know, I was flashing on the fact that I would guess she probably has had a checkpoint inhibitor. She's got metastatic triple-negative disease. Right now, standard of care first-line therapy would be get a checkpoint inhibitor. I don't know, and I've heard a little bit about checkpoint inhibitors in AML. What do we know about checkpoint inhibitors in AML?
So we have done some trials with checkpoint inhibitors. So we do know that when we give checkpoint inhibitors to patients with AML, that they're about 20 or 30% of them are going to have some side effects. So we do know that they're active in these patients. So we've done studies combining checkpoint inhibitors in combination with chemotherapy, in combination with low-dose, high-dose chemotherapy. In general, we have not seen in the myeloid diseases overall the remarkable responses that we've seen in lymphoid diseases or in solid tumors. There just doesn't seem to be a huge immune component to the disease. So we're not seeing 70, 80, 90% response rates. We do see some patients have stable disease with the checkpoint inhibitors. We think that maybe over the long time, a subset of these patients may have prolonged event or progression-free survival, but we're not seeing differences in remission rates. And we are seeing about 20 or 30% of them having some immune toxicity, pneumonitis, colitis. In fact, there was a trial of checkpoint inhibitors added to epigenetic therapy for patients with older unfit patients with AML and patients with MDS. And a couple of those trials in those older unfit patients were actually held because a few of those patients died because of the immune toxicity is associated with that. So I do think that immune checkpoint inhibitors, they appear to work in a select population of leukemia patients that maybe have immune priming or an immune microenvironment. And we do see maybe some stable disease, but it really hasn't been the home run that we've seen in the other cancers, unfortunately.
Not exactly sure it's a home run in all the other cancers, but maybe sounds a little bit more active. The other flip side that I was kind of thinking about with her breast cancer, I was recalling an interview I did with Dan Pollier, and he was talking about venetoclax combinations, venetoclax HMA, and his theory, and I think other people have thought about the possibility that it's affecting stem cells.
Right.
And he was mentioning that there are other cancers that have similar stem cell biology. He mentioned breast cancer. I was just curious whether venetoclax or venetoclax combination has ever been used in breast cancer.
I'm not sure. I mean, it is an intriguing possibility. Most of the data suggests venetoclax works best in AML in combination with a hypomethylating agent. So I think that it would be intriguing to think about that in her case. I don't know. I mean, I think that Is BCL2 expression important for maintenance of leukemic stem cells? Yes, there's preclinical data to support that. Does BCL2 overexpression play a role in breast cancer stem cell biology? I don't know. I think that would be very intriguing to think about that. I think that's certainly something we could consider.
I've been asking the breast cancer people about it and telling them about it. It doesn't seem like it's kind of gotten in there yet, but we'll see. Always looking for something different.
No, I think that's a great thought.
Let's hear a little bit about your 42-year-old man, because another issue, and again, I think this is really important for general medical oncologists to know about, is IDH inhibition.
Okay.
And you have this 42-year-old man, so let's hear about him.
So this is a very unfortunate gentleman. He's sort of really a good deeder. He's a 42-year-old gentleman. He started his own business. He inherited from his father. He's major comorbidity prior to his diagnosis of his leukemia was really having only one kidney. And the reason he did only one kidney is he donated it to his father, actually. So he comes in and he had presented with some groin swelling and had gotten bigger and bigger and gotten some antibiotics for it. Didn't get better. It was in his left groin. So he finally was referred by his primary care doctor to a surgeon to have a biopsy. And incidentally, his primary care doctor also drew some lab work. So the lab work came back showing about 10 or 20% peripheral blasts in his blood work around the same time that the surgeon had biopsied the inguinal mass and had found that it represented a myeloid sarcoma or extramedullary AML. So he was referred to our service. We repeated a bone marrow, evaluated the blasts. He had what we would call a favorable cytogenetic profile with a translocation 821, but unfortunately, his disease was characterized by additional cytogenetic abnormalities as well as a very aberrant molecular profile. He had not only the RUNX1, but he also had evidence of a IDH2 mutation. So we had tried to treat him. He was young. He was healthy. We went ahead and gave him conventional high-dose chemotherapy with 7+3. We added gemtuzumab because his cells expressed CD33 and he did have a translocation 821. He went into remission and he went on to get a couple cycles of consolidation. There was some debate about, given, you know, various pros and cons, whether he should go to an allogeneic transplant. We were in the middle of considering that when he relapsed. And at the time of relapse, we gave him the venetoclax HMA therapy that we were just discussing as a salvage regimen, and that managed to decrease his disease that was in his bone marrow, but unfortunately still had some evidence of leukemia remaining. At this point, his disease is characterized by the IDH2 mutation. We went back to our pharmacy and we've started him on therapy with an IDH2 inhibitor to try to keep the disease in check while we pursue the logistics of potentially an allogeneic stem cell transplantation for him.
So what agent is he actually on and how is he tolerating it?
He is on enasidenib and he just started it and he is tolerating it fine. His counts are relatively low. What we're looking for and what we look for all patients that we put on IDH and sometimes FLT3 inhibitors is evidence of a clinical differentiation syndrome. Things like fever, infiltrates, shortness of breath, weight gain, things that we typically would see in the past when we gave retinoic acid to our APL patients. We're now seeing similar biological phenomena occurring with some of these other targeted therapies, particularly IDH1, IDH2 inhibitors, and FLT3 inhibitors. And enasidenib is the first drug to be approved for IDH2 mutant disease. There's a sister compound, ivosidenib, which is approved for the IDH1 mutant disease. And both of these agents have very similar response rates, about 40% in the relapse refractory setting. Very well tolerated, except for differentiation syndrome. But differentiation syndrome, definitely something to keep in mind because some people do die from it. So it's something that we would keep an eye on. Doesn't happen right away. Happens after about 2 to 4 weeks. Could happen up to, 2 months after it. So this is something that we need to be continuing to see our patients for. And when they develop shortness of breath, fever, infiltrates, and weight gain, not to just treat them with antibiotics, but to think about this as a chemotherapy complication.
So I want to hear a little bit more about differentiation syndrome. But first, again, just sort of listening to people talk about, reading about it, is there any difference between IDH1 and 2 clinically and IDH1 inhibitors and IDH2 inhibitors? It kind of seems almost exactly the same.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you look at the data, they are different agents inhibiting different mutations and different isoforms of the IDH enzyme. However, the drugs are remarkably similar. They both have similar instances of differentiation syndrome and similar phenomenon. Is there a big difference between them? I think that clinically, there's not necessarily. I think IDH2 is slightly more common, the mutation, than IDH1. Interestingly enough, there's some interesting preclinical data now saying when somebody fails an IDH2 inhibitor, so somebody's on an inhibitor and they progress, there's some data now that leukemia cells, again, they're very wily, are able to switch their mutation. They can switch from being reliant on a mutant IDH2 to being reliant on a mutant IDH1 as a mechanism to avoid, to have recurrence. So it's very interesting. And then similarly to other kinases, you can develop mutations in these. But I did recently see that isoform switching is a way that these cells can avoid the inhibitory effects of one drug versus another drug.
Wow, I've never heard that. So can you use the other drug in that situation?
I would think that you would, right? And in fact, the company that developed these had initially a combination IDH1, IDH2 inhibitor that they didn't move forward into trials for acute leukemias. But I think that the problem we have with IDH1, IDH2 is it's not very common. It's generally thought of not as a driver mutation, but as a founder mutation. We had talked about that. So there are mutations that occur potentially in hematopoietic stem cells. It could be age-related or therapy-related. These mutations are called clonal hematopoietic mutations. And as one ages, just as your stem cells are aging and they can acquire some of these baseline mutations, which are what we call founder mutations. And then what happens again over time or after exposure to certain things or just proliferation, you can develop secondary mutations. And those mutations could be what we call driver mutations, like FLT3 and RAS. And those driver mutations are what takes those aberrant clonal hematopoietic mutated cells into driving them into a leukemia. There are certain founder mutations like P53 that over a 10-year period can be associated with almost a 100% incidence of acute leukemias. So I think these mutations are a series of very active investigation to figure out whether there's a possibility of targeting them early, late, and how best to deal with these mutations.
Well, that's really interesting. Where are these agents approved clinically, and what do we know about their use in the upfront setting, either alone, for example, in an elderly patient, or combined with chemo?
So they have established a very firm niche in the relapse refractory setting. What has been coming to the forefront since these drugs were approved is the routine testing of acute myeloid leukemia cells at diagnosis and at relapse for the possibility that these agents could be used in that select population of patients. So right now in the relapse refractory setting, overall response rate is about 40% with both agent. Clear CR, CRI rates in about 20%, but clearly very useful. These agents have subsequently gone to the upfront setting as monotherapy, and early studies of early phase one data that's been published has suggested very similar response rates in the upfront setting, but a little disappointing. You know, we had thought maybe if we move it up front and they haven't pre-treated, we would get higher response rates than 30 or 40%, and we really haven't. However, for patients who are elderly and unfit, and remember, patients, the average age of presentation of acute myeloid leukemia is really 67 to 70 years old. So we're talking about a geriatric population. There are certainly patients that get diagnosed with acute leukemia that are not fit for therapy. And using a pill to treat an IDH1 or IDH2 mutant disease is very appealing for older individuals who don't want to spend any time in hospital. So I think we've seen ivosidenib, which is the IDH1 inhibitor, get FDA approval for the upfront setting, as well as relapse refractory. Enasidenib, the IDH2 inhibitor, is only approved in the relapse refractory setting, but the data as monotherapy is very similar to ivosidenib. And then can we layer this on top of, as you mentioned, combination chemotherapy? A couple studies looking at adding IDH1, IDH2 to 7+3. Response rates are pretty good. It's extremely well tolerated. And we're waiting for follow-up data on whether it improves outcomes. CR rates apparently seem about equivalent to what we would see with 7+3 alone. We've seen some very promising data with the addition of IDH1, IDH2 inhibitors to hypomethylating agents. In that particular setting, we're starting to see response rates about 70%. So it looks like IDH1, IDH2 monotherapy is effective in both newly diagnosed and refractory relapse patients with the same efficacy. Most promising combination really looks to be hypomethylating, where we're starting to get 70% response rates.
So we actually recently conducted a survey of 25 AML investigators. You actually were nice enough to participate. One of the things that we saw that was really interesting was older patients with either IDH or FLT3, where, you know, without those abnormalities, we saw the investigators uniformly using venetoclax HMA. But then the question comes up, what about those same patients when they have either FLT3 or IDH? Do you add it in? Do you not use it? How do you approach that?
It is difficult. We're actually, you know, now having an abundance of choices. So it's actually, I think even a few years ago, you had a 75-year-old patient with comorbidities with AML. I tell you, we would have just said, oh, go home. You know, one option would be hospice, right? Then we started using some hypomethylating agents. And now we're like confounded. We have pills, we have IDH mutations, FLT3 mutations, venetoclax, glostigib, you know, where do we go? I think that my approach is really in that older individual is really to determine what they want in terms of a preference. And now my impression, again, I'm getting older every minute that I'm sitting here, but my impression is most people in their 60s, 70s, or 80s have lived a full life and they know what they want to do with the rest of their lives. They've seen family members come and go. They have relationships. So if I have an elderly individual who has, for example, an IDH mutant disease, I'm going to say to them, do you want to get venetoclax HMA? In our center, that requires you to come into the hospital for a minimum 1 week and possibly 3 or 4 weeks, depending on the complications that you develop with the myelosuppression. Then you need to make the commitment to continue to get that HMA every week of every month going forward until it stops working, and or to take the venetoclax pill and come in for transfusion support. So there are some people that would say, I don't really want to be hospitalized for a week, 3 or 4 weeks. I don't really want to get 1 week of hypomethylating therapy for the rest of my life, okay? Best case scenario, this works. That's what we're looking at, right? We don't know how long to give the hypomethylating agent. We don't know how long to give venetoclax. We do, with that upfront regimen, get about 50% of our patients alive at a year or 2 years afterwards. But that's with a significant amount of time at our center, right? Then there are going to be some patients that say, I don't really want to do that. And for those patients, despite the high response rates, 60, 70, 80, 90% response rates with the venetoclax-based regimen, some of those patients are going to say, particularly the IDH1, IDH2, they are offered the option to take a pill and to go home. Okay, the IDH1, IDH2 are not associated with very much transfusion dependence. In fact, numerous of those patients and part of the approval of those agents in the unfit population was because they make a certain percentage of those patients transfusion independent. I would have to say that the overwhelming majority of my patients treated with venetoclax become transfusion dependent for some degree of time. So I think that when we look at pure response rates for IDH mutant disease, newly diagnosed, older, unfit, clearly the winner is venetoclax HMA-based therapy. But for certain individuals who don't want the side effects or the duration of treatment, IDH inhibitors are an option. Similarly, for FLT3, I would, in contrast in FLT3, I would always advocate using a FLT3 agent upfront. I feel like, again, as we've talked about, suppressing that clone is important to me. There is also emerging data that although FLT3 mutant AML patients respond similarly, maybe 50% or more with venetoclax HMA-based regimens, there is emerging data when you look at patients who recur after venetoclax HMA, they are recurring, high percentage of them are recurring with FLT3 mutations. And if you look at patients that don't respond, a high percentage of those patients have FLT3 mutations. So FLT3 mutation could be a very relevant clinical mechanism of resistance to ven-HMA, in which case I would rather do a FLT3 inhibitor upfront. That's just my bias.
Getting back to your older patient, that 75-year-old patient says to you, look, I want everything. It can keep me alive any extra day. Would you give venetoclax HMA plus IDH or FLT3?
I would love to do that. That's currently what we would call off-label use. What we have done in some patients, like, for example, if we had somebody who was FLT3 mutant, and we didn't realize they were FLT3 mutant, and maybe we didn't get the result back. We have started them on ven-HMA therapy, and then if they've had recurrence or had disease that's been stabilized, we might add a FLT3 inhibitor. If they still have disease, doing sequential therapy. Right now, we're looking at a lot of clinical trials looking at combinations, and that's exactly what we're looking at.
It's interesting. You use that term abundance of riches, and I think there's been like 8 drugs approved in AML in the last couple of years, but I saw it was either a paper or a presentation you gave where you went into the background of the phrase abundance of riches. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes. So, I mean, I do think it's an abundance of riches. I think the definition is technically that there's so many riches that you don't know which one to pick. So it's sort of like at Christmas time when you have all of these presents and you can't figure out which one to open first, which one's going to be best. I think we're in that period of time where, you know, in the old days, my job as a leukemia physician, I mean, I've been a leukemia physician for 15 years now. It was really simple. Like, you either got high-dose chemotherapy or you went to hospice. If you weren't fit enough to get 7 and 3, then we didn't have anything, right? And you remember those days. I mean, that's when we talk to a lot of community physicians, that's how they trained, okay? Their training is they're fit enough to get aggressive therapy or not. Recently, we've been giving hypomethylating therapy. And so that was a change to say, well, now we have hypomethylating therapy, but that still requires a lot of effort. And now we're moving to totally oral-based therapy. Now, I think that we're actually now starting to see, and you'll see this in the community, now patients are saying, I no longer have to go to the academic center and be hospitalized for 6 to 8 weeks. I no longer need to get my therapy only at major medical centers. We're moving some of our AML therapies to the community.
You use the term abundance or riches. I use the term, and maybe not a term, but the concept that nothing has ever happened like this in general medical oncology, where you go from a significant number of patients, of course, I'm talking about the older patient, who, like you said, a lot of these people are going to hospice, to a situation where you can get a response, or relatively non-toxic, at least from a quality of life point of view. And it's amazing. I don't know if you feel this way, but when we talk to people, we've done programs, it seems like a lot of people in the community are using venetoclax HMA. I mean, they're on it. Is that your take?
Yeah. I mean, I do think what we typically do is, as this comes online and we have our colleagues in the community that are referring patients, what we typically are doing is seeing patients, offering the therapy. We sometimes will do the first cycle in-house to manage the complications and the risk of sepsis. And then after 1 or 2 cycles, we're transitioning them back. There are patients that live 3 or 5 hours away. And for those patients, we're helping the community doctors to learn about these things. But the community doctors need to be aware of the things, and they need to be comfortable with these drugs in order to offer those therapies to our patients. We had a patient that was 88 years old. She came to see me with AML because she said her local oncologist had never treated a patient that was 88 years old that had acute leukemia, and he was terrified. So we brought her in. We gave her venetoclax low-dose cytarabine. She had a history of MDS and prior HMA. She went into remission, and we transitioned her out. She comes back once a month now, and we are guiding her oncologist to provide local transfusions and to manage the venetoclax. And for her, she would have been dead if we hadn't had this. And now her oncologist is gradually becoming much more comfortable with having this 88-year-old show up in his office to get venetoclax as an outpatient.
So as usual, when I try to do an interview on acute leukemias, like, we're running out of time, and yet we have so many things to talk about. So I think what I'm going to do is just throw out to you a bunch of these drugs that have come online, as I'm remembering the slide that you show where you show all the approvals, and just get your take, particularly again from the point of view of the general oncologist, in terms of what it means in practice. So I think this patient, the IDH patient, actually got gemtuzumab, correct?
Yes, he did.
Can you talk a little bit about gemtuzumab and where it fits in nowadays?
I think gemtuzumab is the perfect example of a resurgent drug. It has found its niche again. We are now using it in the upfront setting. There's data suggesting it can vastly improve our outcomes for favorable risk patients in addition to standard cytarabine and daunorubicin induction and high-dose cytarabine consolidation. Large studies, retrospective studies, meta-analysis show about a 20% improvement when added to standard 7+3 in consolidation. patient, about a 5.7% improvement in overall survival when adding it to intermediate risk. No role for it in adverse karyotype AML. We are also using it as a less preferred but still an option for elderly unfit patients that don't want any oral agents, that don't want any hypomethylating agents, and just want to come in for some antibody therapy, 2 doses in the first month, 1 dose monthly. There is also obviously a role in the relapse refractory setting, less favored in that setting because of the risk of VOD that's been associated with it. If we do give it to patients, we sometimes will give it for intermediate risk patients in combination with induction, but we omit it from consolidation if those patients are going forward with an allogeneic transplant.
Any other potential tolerabilities other than VOD? Occlusive disease.
Liver toxicity is something that we have to watch out for. So patients with baseline liver dysfunction, not due to their disease, can have issues with gemtuzumab, something that we're keeping an eye on. And obviously, anybody that is, for example, going immediately to stem cell transplantation right after induction chemotherapy, generally the practice has been to give at least a 2-month window between the use of gemtuzumab and a myeloablative regimen. Certainly, the data suggests if you're going to give a non-myeloablative regimen, particularly in older patients, that it would be safe to go forward in that with gemtuzumab. And gemtuzumab is an agent that we're very familiar with, fallen out of favor a little bit in the targeted therapy, but definitely something that we have back in our regimens now.
So I usually don't get a gigantic response to this one, but I have to put it out there, Glastegib.
Glastegib, again, also has a role. I think that many people are not using it, and I think that's because the baseline regimen that Glastegib has been layered upon has been low-dose cytarabine, and at least in this country, low-dose cytarabine has not been the standard. Glastegib is an oral sonic hedgehog inhibitor, which we think blocks that leukemic stem cell, so it is a very unique mechanism. It improved overall survival when added to low-dose cytarabine in newly diagnosed unfit. However, since the low-dose cytarabine has not been a standard for patients in this country, not in Europe or in Australia and other industries, it's really been not favored. Also, I think people are looking at the outcomes and they're saying that overall, the percentage of patients alive at 12 to 18 months is nowhere near the 50% that we get with a venetoclax-based regimen. The benefit of the Glastegib is, again, there's elderly unfit patients that don't want or cannot tolerate the significant myelosuppression that we see with venetoclax. And the myelosuppression that we get is platelets down to single digits and patients requiring daily or every other day transfusions. There's a lot of elderly patients that can't do that. So for those patients, Glastegib plus a low-dose cytarabine regimen, which can be self-injected, represents a completely outpatient regimen that could be an option for some older, unfit patients.
I don't know how many times you've actually used it, but, you hear pretty nasty stories from the people who treat basal cell about hedgehog inhibitors in terms of tolerability, muscle spasms, lack of appetite and stuff. Do you see that here?
It's an on-target toxicity that they did see in the trials. We haven't seen a lot of it, mostly because most of their side effects that they're getting are from their AML. It may be that we're just not seeing it because the patients aren't healthy enough to begin with to notice some of those issues. We haven't noticed it to be a big problem. We have started a few patients on the combination, but really unfit patients that just can't tolerate the myelosuppression with the other agents.
So I want to spend a few minutes talking about ALL also, but just one other question. You've been talking about oral therapies, and we're going to see some data on oral azacitidine. I'm curious where you think that's heading.
So yeah, oral azacitidine has been like a mirage. Ever since we started using hypomethylating agents for MDS and then for AML, every single one of my patients that comes in for these daily shots has been, Dr. Wang, this is ridiculous. Isn't there an oral medication? So now moving forward, I think that the oral aza is finally moving into market. The problem with azacitidine is that when we give the azacitidine, we give the shots, and the pharmacokinetics are that it wears off, certainly afterwards. So the epigenetic effects fade, but then we're not able to go and give more shots because it's already torture for the patients to come in 7 days in a row once a month. So oral azacitidine not only has a convenience factor, but oral azacitidine and soon I think oral decitabine coming down the pike is going to offer us a way to give these hypomethylating agents and give it more continuously and to have more effective anti-leukemic effect, okay? Because obviously your cancer doesn't take a 3-week break when you stop the hypomethylating component. So oral azacitidine finding presented at the ASH meeting was used in a setting where it was said, well, after you are in remission from your high-dose chemotherapy, there may be a period where we're going to stop all chemotherapy after consolidation. And then patients say, okay, I have this very aggressive cancer. I could have died. What are you doing now, doctor? And I'm going to say, I'm going to stop everything, and we're going to wait to see if the disease comes back. And in that setting, traditionally, 50% of patients or more that go into remission are going to relapse. So this was attempting to address that and to randomize patients to getting oral azacitidine versus nothing when then into remission to decrease the risk of relapse. And the data show that adding something versus nothing is better than nothing, right? Epigenetic agents, well tolerated, taken as a pill, low dose, can provide long-term epigenetic modification, which can prevent in a certain percent of patients relapse from occurring and therefore translate into an overall survival benefit.
But it's interesting the point you're making about pharmacokinetics, because you might expect the possibility that just because of the convenience that you could actually maybe achieve a therapeutic advantage. I remember when I first heard about exazimab, the oral proteasome inhibitor for myeloma, I was thinking, you know, maybe the pharmacokinetics of that's going to change actually the efficacy. I don't know that that really has happened yet. But do you think, for example, oral hypomethylating agents plus venetoclax?
I think that's a new world. I think so, because I think it depends on the mechanism of the drug. Like, for example, if you had oral cytarabine, I don't think that would work, because that drug works by killing off rapidly proliferating cells, and you're not going to have rapid proliferating cells every single day that you have acute leukemia. But the epigenetics agents work by removing methylation groups and allowing for a de-repression of processes at the gene level that are important for normal hematopoiesis, okay, and for anti-leukemia effects. So hypomethylating agents in and of themselves take 4 or 6 months to work. So with that mechanism of action of these epigenetic long-term administration in order to get biological effects, they're ideally suited for a long-term oral administration in a maintenance setting when you look biologically, as opposed to like oral cytarabine. So I think moving towards a totally oral combinations, I think would be where we'd like to go, right?
Were there any data presented at ASH on up-and-coming novel agents that you found promising or interesting?
I do think that there are some interesting studies. There is a drug, APR246, which is for a subset of acute leukemia, P53 mutant, and that is a small molecular reactivator of mutant P53, which has reportedly resulted in very high response rates in notoriously horrible, dismal prognostic subset of acute myeloid leukemia and myelodysplastic syndrome. And I think that we're looking forward to that, because I think that agent might be the next agent to potentially be approved if the results hold out in larger scale studies.
This P53 thing sounds really interesting. What kind of a substance is it?
It's a small molecule, and it's been in development. What it does is it binds and it results in reactivation. So P53 is a tumor suppressor gene, right? So it's found universally almost all cancers. And the suppression of a tumor suppressor gene then leads to pro-tumorigenic effects, right? So in about 5-10% of AMLs, they're characterized, particularly complex karyotype AMLs are characterized by P53 mutation. And those particular P53 mutant patients do horribly with standard chemotherapy. They relapse after transplant, and they have very short overall survival. I just had a patient, 31-year-old, who just died after transplant and multiple rounds of therapy with this very resistant subtype. This particular small molecule inhibitor goes in and results in reactivation of P53, so allows the normal function of P53 to be restored, and also has some direct toxic effects on the leukemia cells. But that particular drug in early studies reportedly has very high 60, 70, even 80, 90% response rates in that very poor subset that we would really expect only 10 or 20% response rates.
So as you said, P53 is a, you know, cancer-wide issue. Is this the only such agent that's been used? Has it been used in other tumors?
I think they are looking at it in solid tumor. I'm not familiar with the solid tumor data, but the data in liquid tumors, you know, with really myeloid malignancies, AML and MDS really looks very intriguing and very promising.
That's really interesting. So I want to finish out with a couple questions on ALL, and I think that's a cancer that a lot of general medical oncologists are kind of referring out and see it from the point of view of secondarily being involved. But there are some things going on there that I think are really interesting and potentially relevant to docs who are going to be following these people in practice. And one has to do with the evolution of blinatumomab, But the other agent is inotuzumab. Can you talk a little bit about those two agents, what they are, and right now how they're being currently integrated into the care of patients with ALL?
So blinatumomab is a bispecific antibody. It works by activating the immune system. Now, we know that in ALL, the immune system is very important. So the drug goes in, binds to CD19 as well as CD3, and activates the host immune system to identify and eradicate residual disease. Blinatumomab has been found to be highly effective not only in the relapse refractory setting, but in minimal residual disease, and is now approved for the use of patients who, after standard cytotoxic chemotherapy, have measurable residual disease by PCR or by flow cytometry. And the blinatumomab is used as a measurable residual disease eraser in that setting, as well as an overt relapse. Inotuzumab is different. Inotuzumab is a standard chemotherapy agent attached to a CD22 antibody, also expressed on BALL cells. Inotuzumab has been used in the relapse refractory setting, has very high response rates, 80% in the first relapse setting, and is an agent that can continuously be given. But we think that because it's attached to a DNA damaging agent, there are side effects, and because of the conjugation effects, it also is associated with VOD. Blinatumomab and inotuzumab have changed the landscape for patients with relapse refractory disease, particularly adult patients that cannot be cured. Pediatric patients' cure rates 80, 90, 95%. In older adults, where we're seeing it more and more common, cure rates are down to 30, 40%. And many elderly individuals, similarly to elderly individuals with acute myeloid leukemia, can't tolerate cytotoxic. Where we see those drugs, we are seeing increasing use of blinatumomab to eradicate disease in combination with cytotoxic therapy in the upfront setting. There are now trials moving inotuzumab into the upfront therapy in combination with induction chemotherapy and as a consolidation chemotherapy. So using it as another chemotherapy agent in our arsenal and reserving blinatumomab for measurable residual disease, or blinatumomab and inotuzumab, can we get rid of chemotherapy completely? So there are some regimens that are taking out the cytotoxics for those older unfit patients and only giving them these two antibody drug agents to see whether that in combination with maybe low-dose chemotherapy or steroids could control disease in patients biologically without the need for high-dose chemo.
You seem to have a great eye for not only, you know, clinical toxicities, but how it affects people's lives. What do people go through both in terms of toxicities as well as inconvenience when receiving both of these agents or either of them?
The challenge with blinatumomab is because it is a bispecific antibody, it has to be continuously infused for 28 days. Also because it activates the immune system similarly to checkpoint inhibitors or CAR T cells, there is a risk of cytokine release and neurological phenomenon. So there is currently the recommendation for patients with active relapse refractory disease that they be in the hospital for cycle one of blinatumomab for 10 days. And obviously a 28-day infusion is something that logistically has to be managed outpatient and with independent patients' lives. So 28-day continuous infusion is clearly not optimal, can be something that is limiting. Inotuzumab is easier to give. It's a cytotoxic, so we give it in clinic usually one time a week for many weeks in a row. But over time, patients can develop. I have a patient now that I think has developed a secondary myelodysplastic syndrome from the continuous administration of cytotoxics, including inotuzumab. So the challenges with inotuzumab, really the myelosuppression, the risk of VOD in certain patients, blinatumomab, the 28-day infusion.
Inotuzumab has been associated with VOD?
Yes. 11 to 14% of patients given the initial doses of inotuzumab at the higher doses developed VOD, some of them in conjunction with subsequent allogeneic stem cell transplantation. Now, veno-occlusive disorder has been most associated with gemtuzumab. The recent redosing or reemergence of gemtuzumab was premised based on new toxicity data that when you dropped the dose of gemtuzumab from 9 milligrams per meter squared to 3 milligrams per meter squared, the risk of veno-occlusive disorder went down to about 4% in the upfront setting. Similarly, with inotuzumab, we're getting the same lessons that we're learning. Reducing the dose of inotuzumab to lower doses in a chronic setting seems to be associated with a reduced rate of those veno-occlusive disorder. And something that we're really looking closely at, patients with relapsed ALL going to transplant should really have only two cycles of inotuzumab and again an interval if possible.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Acute Leukemias Update.